We're doing Parashat Mishpatim. We did the first half of the parasha last night. And we left off with the laws of a person taking responsibility over someone else's object. And we described that you could be a Shomer Chinam and a Shomer Sachar. A person could take responsibility for free. Someone says, hey, watch my laptop. He goes out, comes back a half hour later, and some damage is done to the laptop. So the guy wasn't paid for watching his laptop. He has less responsibility. Then you have a Shomer Sachar. You have a guy who's being paid to watch things. You come into a garage, you pay, you park your car. They have more responsibility. They have to cover theft. They have to cover if it suddenly disappears, you know, got lost or something among the cars. And then we left off where we really have to go on to Shoel. What about a person who borrows something? So a person who borrows something is responsible for everything, basically. You know, you borrow an animal and it dies, you're responsible. The guy gave you a full-fledged favor. You borrowed it, so you say, we say you're responsible even for things that were beyond your control. You borrowed it, so take care of it. And if it died, okay, so you got to pay up. And here we have a very interesting halacha. The Torah says there's a concept of be'alav imo. The concept of be'alav imo literally means if the master is with the object. But we have on tradition that it means in a special way, meaning, let's say the guy was doing me a favor as I borrowed it from him. So let's say a guy is coming to my house and he's going to help me paint my house. And as we're painting, I say, gee, Bob, could I borrow your paintbrush? And he gives me the paintbrush. And as I'm painting with the paintbrush, lightning strikes the paintbrush and psst, it's all burnt up. So that I couldn't help that. Or robbers walk in and say, give us that paintbrush. Or whatever happens beyond my control. So even though ordinarily as a shoel you'd be responsible, the Torah says, being that he was working on your behalf at the time that the loan began, you're not responsible. Now, technically, this goes even as far as, let's say you wanted to borrow someone's car, and you said to him, Bob, could you get me a cup of water? And he's like, go, okay. He goes to get you a cup of water. As he's going to get you the cup of water, he's doing you a service, right? Technically, if at that moment, as he's working on your behalf to get you a cup of water, you'd say, Bob, can I borrow the car tomorrow? Can I borrow the car now? You know, I have the keys. Can I go off with the car? He says, what about the cup of water? You say, yeah, after you bring me the cup of water, I'm going to go driving off. I'll be back. And he says, fine. If you borrowed that car while he was getting you the cup of water, technically that's considered that he was working on your behalf at the time that the loan began, and then you're absolved from much of the responsibility as a borrower. And the question is, what's the logic behind that? So we don't know exactly what the Torah's logic in that was, but part of the idea is that we say, if you guys have such a close relationship that he was willing to do you favors other than lend you his car, he was willing to do you other favors and do things for you on your behalf, then we assume that even though ordinarily you hold a borrower responsible to a higher level, but here the Torah says, no, he doesn't hold you to that higher level. But the truth is that this is a halacha that's very hard to understand. Yes.
If you're borrowing in this situation, though, and you have, like, I mean, I feel like it's like a loophole in order to, like, get out of, like, a responsibility that you have to a person. Like, if someone's, right. If you borrow someone's car, I mean, like, who's going to pull this out of, like, even if you were to be like, hey, it says here that I'm not really responsible, like, does Hashem look at you as you're not responsible, or is Hashem is like...
Here we have an interesting thing. We see in all the laws of damages... Yeah. That the Torah gives us a legal system, and we have a mitzvah to work with that legal system. Sometimes the legal system insists, do lifnim ashur sadin, do beyond the call of duty. The Talmud says one of the rabbis once hired workers to carry his barrels. They were carrying his barrels and they dropped the barrels. So they went to court, and the judge said they don't have to pay for the barrels. They worked their best and they dropped the barrels, okay, they don't have to pay for the barrels. So the guy says, Dina hachi, is that really the halacha? He says, yeah, lifnei mishur sadin. You got to go beyond the call of duty. Our sages tell us that Jerusalem was destroyed over the fact that people went within the call of duty. Why was Jerusalem destroyed? Because everyone said, these are my rights, you got to give me my rights. So in that sense, Gidon is right. Chazal tells that brought about destruction. You can't live life like that. Chazal say that's what brought Jerusalem's destruction. One of the commentaries says that that's why Pirkei Avos is within the order of Nezikin, damages, because people learn of Nezikin and they walk away and they say, gee, so if I want to borrow his car, I'll first say, hey, could you get me a cup of water? And then I won't be so responsible and he's doing me a favor and I'll get out of it. And guys are learning all day. You guys are learning Baba Basra now. So you know there are all kinds of ways to legally skimp your friend, right? So what? Could find ways to kill him. That's also true. You could even find ways to kill him. That's right. That's true. What? There are ways, right? There are ways that a court wouldn't be able to touch you, but then the court finds ways to kill the person too, you know. If the guy found a way to murder where halachically he didn't do anything bad, so the court will also kill him in a way that halachically they didn't give him the death penalty. You know, it goes both ways. Right, then there's that sticky matter, right, that Hashem's watching, right. But at any rate, so that's why Chazal incorporated in the very end of Nezikin, after you learn all the technical laws of damages, we have Pirkei Avot, which teaches us how to be moral people. It's not only about the technical laws, but right now we're in a parsha that deals with all the technical laws. Okay, so the Torah tells us we're not allowed to leave around a mechashefa, a witch. So what's a witch? So the Talmud goes into what a witch is. Really, this has nothing to do with male or female. If a person performs sorcery, then they're liable to get the death penalty. And that's why a person, before he starts exploring all of these alternative medicines, should verify if it's biblically permitted or biblically prohibited before you start going into all this EGBG. You know, no, really, you know, I once saw, what do they call it? I don't remember what it's called, where this woman wanted to see, from woman, a rebbetzin, she wanted to see which plants from the Bach plants would be good for a new customer. She never met the woman before. So she tells the woman names, and every name of a plant that she says, she tries to push her hand down. Now, the woman who's having her hand pushed down, she says, pick up your hand and I'll push it down. Pick up your hand and I'll push it down. She says the name of a plant, tries to push it down. If the hand goes down, no, that's not a good plant for you. The hand doesn't go down, you see, your body says that's a good plant for you. So the woman says, but I never heard of these plants before. How does my body know their names if I never heard of them before? She says, believe me, this is how it works. Okay, I question whether things like that aren't within the realm of the prohibition of doing sorcery. You know, there's no logic to it. There's no science to it. There's no reasonable reason why this should make sense or work. I don't know, but you have to look into this stuff. There are halachos, there are simanim in Shulchan Aruch that discuss what's permitted and what's prohibited. And why does the Torah say a witch? What about a male, a warlock? You know, what's the difference? So the idea is that women have a greater tendency to connect with things that don't fall in the realm of logic. You'll find women much more quickly doing things that are alternative medicine. The ratio points in that direction, and Chazal knew that. The Rambam says in his day and age, it was common practice that a baby was born, just after he was born, they take him and wave him around the candle. So the Rambam says that's leftover from Molech. The Rambam says that's leftover from the idol worship of Molech. We don't do superstitious things. We don't say, if a black cat crossed my path, I don't walk down that path. We don't do that. It's prohibited. And a person has to take care. It's very difficult to know these halachot. Some people have a custom when you enter a house, the first time you're going to live in a house, you put under the oven a coin and sugar and salt and I don't know what else. So you got to ask your local Orthodox rabbi whether you're allowed to do that or not. There's no logic in doing that. And then you have customs that we also can't explain the logic behind them, and they are valid. So it's very hard in this area to call the shot. You have to find someone who could call the shots. It's not clear whether it's permitted to wear those red ribbons. The Tosefta in Shabbos says that that's a form of idol worship, wearing red ribbons. It's part of Darchei HaEmori. The Torah says, don't go like the Emori, and it says over there, the Emori used to wear red ribbons. So people don't know this, but Rav Mordechai Elio wasn't for them. He held it's really questionable whether it's permitted to wear the red ribbons. So I know all these guys collecting money aren't going to be happy with me, because you give them 20 shekel, they mumble a bunch of words, and they put it on you, and they say, this is good for good luck, don't take it off till you come and give me another 20 shekel. So, you guys have to know, before you're going to start doing strange things, you have to find out where it falls in. And about alternative medicine, there's really a lot of discussion. It depends which type of alternative medicine. It's very interesting because on the other hand, you have homeopathic medicine, which basically takes things beyond Avogadro's principle, which Avogadro's principle is that when you take a certain, when you break something down a certain number of times, what is it? I don't remember the number anymore. I know, but what's the number? It's 10 to the which power? I don't remember.
There's 10 to the 23rd, 6 point something times 10 to the 23rd.
Yeah, sounds right. Okay. So in homeopathic medicine, they'll take the base element, which they hold is what's healing you, and they'll dilute it beyond Avogadro's principle, which means molecularly, science considers it as non-existent, and yet they say this chemical is going to heal you. So some people will say that doesn't work, and then other people will swear it does work. And you have countries where that's legalized medicine. So it's a question in halacha, but if a person wanted to use homeopathic medicine, so there's what they're relying on. A person could. That's been accepted, even though we don't exactly understand how that works. You have to find out, you know, different elements within homeopathic medicine might be kosher or non-kosher. That's a different question. But with regard to the question of the sorcery or valid medicine, there's definitely a response out there that accept it. Okay, we'll go in order here, but guys, we can't go. This is just one pasuk. 1 second. Wait, Ariel was before you. 1 second, was Ariel? Yeah.
You're saying the lady who's done her hand, it might be a kishuv. I just think instead, I think it might be a menahesh.
Okay.
It's just he describes menahesh as someone who gives a lot of significance to something excessively insignificant.
Okay. Zev was next. Sorry, guys. Yeah.
So it's just a little bit, and this might be kind of off topic, but this is a question that's been bothering me for a while, which is the sorceress that David Hamelach comes to.
We're getting up to that in Mitzvah on Sunday. Only I probably will not make it here for Sunday's class. I have to undergo a medical procedure, and I don't think I'll make it here for Sunday. So next week, Sunday. Where are they going to do it? You guys have a party Sunday night, so.
If she's supposed to be killed,
good question. Bezrat Hashem, the answer to that is already online from last year's class. If you want to hear it live, submit Hashem a week from Sunday. Yeah. We're just saying, Boaz, yeah.
Are you familiar with Reiki?
Yeah.
Okay. So, my mother and sister, they both did that. And they told me it's part of the initiation. Before you become a Reiki master, and you have to do this formula, and what you're actually doing is letting a spirit, an evil spirit, into your body that enables you to do Reiki. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. Exactly. No, because I here in Israel, they teach Reiki, and they don't teach it with that.
Well, I'm telling you, in America, before you become a Reiki master, you have to accept this thing with spirit or whatever, and you do do something, you're accepting a spirit into your body, and it helps. Enables you to be effective.
Interesting. Yeah. No.
Sounds like witchcraft.
Just a pasuk is juxtaposition between these two, like bestiality on the one hand and sleeping with the. What's the question?
Okay, so it's Thursday night, so we could go off on a little tangent. If you want to understand the kesher in truth, so technically we don't know the kesher between the psukim here, but. There is, this goes in line with what Boaz was mentioning earlier, there is a Kli Yakar, and this is Yalkut Me'amlois, I'm sorry, there's a Yalkut Me'amlois on Parshas Balak that discusses how does one become an evil sorcerer like Bilam. And the Kli Yakar goes through a whole procedure of where you have to travel in the desert and what snakes you have to encounter. The Me'amlois, I'm sorry. And you guys want to learn it?
Yes.
You want to learn how to be an evil sorcerer?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to teach you. So I guess we'll say it, and I already told you where you can find it. So if you want to learn it, maybe at the end of class at 11:30 tonight, when everyone's eyes are drowsy, then then we'll learn it. But in a nutshell, he says one of the things that a person has to do is commit bestiality with a donkey. And he also, that's what Bilam did. As I'll say Bilam did that. It's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So I... That might be why there's a juxtaposition between the prohibition of sorcery and sleeping with an animal, because Kabbalistically there is a connection. There is a connection. There's more to it, but I guess you could call it that. Initiation has a lot of connotations, and I'm not sure that I agree with all of them. But okay. Yes. We're talking about that donkey.
What?
That donkey, yeah. Why did he take that donkey? For his knights, yeah. The Torah tells us, Zovech le'Elohim yachoram, a person who sacrifices to all gods. Let's say a guy says, I'm a pluralistic guy, so I'll accept Judaism, and I'll accept Christianity, and I'll accept Hinduism. They're all right. It's all okay. I pray to all of them. Torah says that's prohibited. Bilti l'Hashem levado. Hashem says, I'm alone, no one else. You want to start worshipping more than one, doesn't work. Judaism prohibits. It's one of the things we declare, morning, night, as we're about to fall asleep. Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We put it on our doorposts, we put it in the mezuzah, we wear it on our arms, on our heads, in the tefillin.
In our walls.
What? On our walls. Yeah, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, one, no, nothing else. So the Torah says, and don't think you could just say, I'll do them plus God. No, it doesn't work. We have a special prohibition not to afflict the ger. The Torah warns us, remember, you know what it's like. You were gerim, and the Torah is telling us something even deeper. The Torah is saying, when you were gerim in Egypt, did you have any right to leave Egypt? I cared for you because I care for the afflicted. By the same token, if you have a ger and you afflict him, he doesn't need to have any rights in order for me to take up his case. I'll take up his case simply because he's a ger. He's a newcomer. And I always go for the underdog. That's Hashem's description. Whenever you see Hashem's description of greatness, you see right afterwards, what's Hashem's greatness? Hashem looks for the underdog. Who's on the bottom rung? Whoever's on the bottom gets Hashem's help. And traditionally, gerim had it harder. You know, a guy becomes a ger, he has to make ends meet without his family. He's not continuing the family business. He's moving to a territory where he doesn't have a lot. He's moving into Israel. He has to make new friends, new acquaintances, new reputation. He has to learn a whole bunch of new things. Often he has to learn a new language. So traditionally, the ger was usually on the bottom rung. Today, life is easier. You could become a ger, come live in Israel, and over the internet, still work your job out in Switzerland. It's a different world today. But even today, there are the hardships. A guy is without family, and we have a special prohibition to take special care. Now, the Torah prohibits afflicting a ger. The Torah gives us a mitzvah to love a ger. So we have an obligation to love every Jew, and then we have an added obligation to love a ger. And in many places, the Torah repeats this mitzvah. And you guys are in a very unique position, because you can fulfill this mitzvah, and most Jews cannot. Most Jews don't encounter gerim throughout their lives. You guys here in Machon Meir, this is a mitzvah that you can fulfill many times a day. But here's a catch. Why should a ger get special status? So there are opinions that say that not every ger gets this special status, that you have to love him and treat him special. There are gerim, and then there are gerei tzedek. You have a ger who became a ger because that's good, you know. He was living out in Uzbekistan, and if he comes here, he gets sal klita, the government will fund his education. There are a lot of reasons, and anyways, it's nice to be Jewish. There are good Jewish girls. And anyways, you know, monotheism seems to make sense. So a guy like that, he's called a ger. He's a regular ger. Then you have a guy who, he had a job, or even if he didn't have a job, life was okay. And he came to the conclusion, this is what's right. And when he came to the conclusion, so he said, I'm going to become a ger. That's called a ger tzedek. You'll notice we speak about ger tzedek when we speak about ger. Usually, ger tzedek is to ensure that you understand we're not talking about a ger toshav. Meaning a ger toshav is a non-Jew who accepts the seven Noahide laws, but he's not Jewish. He just accepts to keep the seven Noahide laws and lives here in Israel. So that's called the ger toshav. Usually when we say ger tzedek, we mean in contradistinction with a ger toshav. But some opinions hold that No, there's ger and ger tzedek. And all the special things that the Torah says, love the ger and help the ger, and everything that the Torah says, give him special treatment, is specifically for a ger tzedek. And if you want to look online, last year or 2 years ago, when it was Dov's Yahrzeit, Reuven Dov Bera Ezrochi, the one who we do Dov's Minute in memory of, so he was a ger. And we had a whole class on gerim. And in that class, we brought many midrashim that discussed this distinction. We didn't spell it out as well as we're spelling it out here, but we brought many midrashim that discussed gerim and gerim's present and future status. The Torah gives a special mitzvah, do not afflict a widow or an orphan. And then the Torah, as we see throughout our parsha, uses double terminology. Im ane te ane oto. If afflict, you will afflict him. Then God says, I will listen to his cry, and I'll be upset, and I'll kill you, and your wives will be widows, your children will be orphans. The question is, why use the double terminology? So one understanding says that the Torah was telling us, imane te'aneoto, if you afflict him for the sake of afflicting. But let's say you're his teacher. Let's say you're teaching an orphan, and at one point you got to yell at him, and you're going to bring him to tears. Then says the Torah, nothing wrong, I'm on your side. So years ago, this goes back maybe a decade ago, I was teaching an orphan, and I felt he needed to be yelled at. But I'm scared, the Torah says, you afflict an orphan, God says pretty harsh things. So I called one of my rabbeim, and I said, what am I supposed to do? The kid needs to be yelled at, and it's for his benefit, but I'm scared. So he said, you got to think of it this way. When you teach a regular kid, and you yell at him, so you're lighting a firecracker. You have to know how to light a firecracker, where to place the firecracker, so that you don't blow off your fingers. You're playing with fire when you yell at a regular kid also. You got to make sure you yell the way you should, the time you should, with the words you should. You got to take the things into account. And when you're yelling at an orphan, so then you're lighting dynamite. It's also useful. You just got to know where to place it, how to place it, but that could kill you. A firecracker won't kill you. So we have a mitzvah to help them, and sometimes helping them requires yelling at them. And the Torah doesn't tell us not to do it. The Torah says, don't afflict them for the sake of affliction. The Torah tells us, im kesef talve etami, if you give a loan to my nation, to the poor, then don't take interest. Don't chase after him to pay back and be a pain in the neck. Now here Chazal tell us this is one of the places where the word im doesn't mean if, but rather when. When you give loans. So we have a mitzvah of giving loans, and we have in the Avat Chesed, we learned the laws of giving loans, and the Torah says, if you take collateral, and he needs that collateral, so give it to him when he needs it. And don't take collateral, something that he uses for his livelihood. Let's say he's a bellboy, and he has the suit he wears when he's a bellboy. Don't take that from him. Let's say he's a farmer. Don't take his plow. Leave him his livelihood. So what can you take? You can take his blanket. But then come nighttime, bring him back the blanket. Comes the morning, you come and take your blanket back. So then what's going to be the impetus for him to pay up? If every night he's getting his blanket back, says the Chafetz Chaim, the impetus is it's not very comfortable. All the neighbors see someone's coming, knocking at the door and walking away with your blanket every morning. Even though it's a pain in the neck for you, it's a bigger pain in the neck for him. So the Torah says, you give him what he needs. Even if you have to take collateral, bring it back when he needs it. But you take it at the times that he doesn't need it, and that's enough. We should take collateral. Guys, don't be stupid. I love everyone here. And you guys are all wonderful people. But you know, sometimes people walk through those doors, and they come and they say, could I learn at Machon Meir? And we don't tell them no. And we treat them nicely, and then the guys in class say, oh, the rabbis treat them nicely, he must be a fine fellow. And then the guy comes over to one of the guys in class and says, gee, can I borrow 50 shekel from you? You know how many times guys came here and borrowed 50 shekel from everyone and then disappeared? They spend a day or two, free bed, free food, take loans and disappear. This happens not once a year, a few times a year.
Really?
Yeah, every year. I gave a good example. You know how many times guys come here and then disappear, and suddenly people's laptops disappear, and people's sneakers disappear, and people's, I didn't know t-shirts could be expensive. I remember one Thursday night, you remember this? A guy came up here and said, who took my wash out? He was left with only underwear. You remember that? You remember that? That was 2-3 years ago. He had expensive t-shirts. I didn't know such thing existed. But he had expensive t-shirts, and they disappeared. What? I remember which group it was. I don't remember which guy it was. What? So every year we have this a few times a year. Guys sometimes work here on the internet, and then they go off to the bathroom or to the front door. So if I walk by, I'll stand and watch the laptop till they come back, because there have been many thefts in Machon Meir, not one or two. We have tens a year. We can't check each person that walks into here, what his history is, how many times he sat in prison. You know what? A lot of the guys here have sat in prison many times, and after they come to Machon Meir, they never again get to prison. That's what we're here for. But I wouldn't trust them with my laptop. You don't know who's coming here with what. You don't know who's coming, and the doors are open. Whoever wants could come in and learn. So the Torah tells us, take collateral. Don't be stupid. A guy wants a loan. You could be a nice guy and give him a loan, and at the same time, take collateral. What collateral could I take? I don't know. Think what he has that's valuable. Take his watch. Take, figure out what he has that's of value, and take something real. The Torah warns us not to curse a judge, and this goes back to a basic concept that a person is very partial towards himself. And this is a halachic concept. No one is trusted with regard to themselves. We all see only what's right for ourselves. There's a famous story, one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch once had a court case with another Jew in town. So that Jew said, we can't go to any rabbi around here. They all know you. You're a big rabbi. They'll all tell you that you're right. We have to go to a far out town where no one knows you. So they did some research. They found a far out town somewhere, another location in Europe. And they found a respectable rabbi who they could go to the court case in front of him. They travel out to that rabbi. They present their case. The rabbi listens. Back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Finally, he rules against this big rabbi. So the rabbi says, Rabbi, the one who's in the court case, says to the judge, he says, Your Honor, I'll accept whatever you say, but could you explain to me the logic? So the judge takes out a Shulchan Aruch, opens up to that rabbi's commentary, and shows him where he himself wrote the logic behind his ruling. So the very rabbi who wrote the commentary, his own commentary was a proof against himself. But when he was involved in the court case, he didn't see it that way. So we say, "En adam roechov la'atzmo." A person's never going to see himself as guilty. And that's why the Torah gives us a special warning. Don't curse the judge. Don't curse the leaders. You know, when we're down here, we could all say, if I were prime minister, you know what I would do? It's like they were protesting when there was a point where We were winning. We entered Sinai. We were advancing. Every time the United States promised that they'd send troops and they'd come in, and suddenly the troops didn't show up and our troops were almost killed, but then they won and then they advanced again. If you guys, you could take the chronicles of the New York Times and see the history of how many times the United States kept promising. It's in the New York Times. The United States says tomorrow troops will come. The next day you see the United States troops didn't come. Israel advances another 50 meters. This is the Yom Kippur War. So at some point, Golda Meir froze the troops. And there was a huge protest outside her house. Everyone said, they killed so many of our troops. We have them on the run. Why'd you stop the troops? So she went out and she said, I hear what all of you are saying, but I want you to know, we're holding the middle of the week. Sunday, I didn't have any bullets to give our soldiers. I didn't have bullets. On Sunday, the United States said, we're sending you a shipment of bullets on the condition that you freeze your troops. So what am I supposed to say? I don't have bullets. You know, how could I fight? It's very easy from our perspective to think we would do a better job. We don't have all the cards before us. Now, we do have our job. I'm not saying we shouldn't protest. I'm not saying we shouldn't push. But we shouldn't curse. The Torah says, Elokim lo tikalel v'nasiv amcha lo to'o. Don't be quick to curse the leaders. From down below, we always think we could do a better job. You guys know the joke, the famous story of an Israeli prime minister met an American president. Who was it?
It was Golda Meir.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Say this. You know the story. Yosef, go ahead. I'll get a break. Yeah, I think that's the story, right? So he said he has, I don't know how many citizens were there in the United States then. He said, I got 150 million citizens. So she says, yeah. And I have 3 million prime ministers. The Torah says, don't curse them. You know, you could have your opinion, but don't curse them. The Torah tells us we have to be careful to give the gifts from our crops in correct order. And we have to take the firstborn of our animals and the firstborn of our children. And those are designated to the service of Hashem. And then the Torah goes over to an interesting mitzvah, not to eat animals that weren't slaughtered properly, to eat kosher. Kosher means even if you have kosher meat in the market, if the meat wasn't slaughtered in accordance with halacha, you may not eat that meat. Yeah, it's not enough that it's a chicken. You say, well, chickens are kosher, yes, but there's a slaughtering process, and there's a way that we remove the parts of the chicken that are non-kosher. So when we have an obligation to eat kosher, we have to know that the animal was salted properly and shechted properly, etc. The hechsher should cover all of that. Now, sometimes people go to the shop and they buy liver. So they figure the liver has a hechsher. You got to read closely what it says on the liver. Liver has to be roasted in order to remove the blood. Sometimes they sell you kosher liver, but it says not yet roasted. So you have to know how to roast liver. A lot of liver, in the United States especially, the kosher liver is pre-kashered. They already roasted it, so you have no problem eating it. But when the Torah introduces this mitzvah of eating kosher, the Torah says, "Ve'anshei kodesh tiyunli." Be holy people. The Rambam has a book called Kedusha, holiness. That book covers what, Ariel? Covers the food we eat and covers the women we marry. Those are the two areas where we are described as holy people. What do you eat and who you marry? That's called Kiddushin, who you marry, but it's also about what you eat. And one of the areas that people are sometimes lax and they don't realize they have to be careful is about not eating bugs. You got to know. Don't take the most stringent book. Get a rabbi, because rabbis will be more lenient than the books. But find out where you have to worry about bugs and where not. And don't eat bugs. Bugs aren't kosher. The Torah warns us not to give false testimony. The Torah warns us not to swear falsely. And here it's not only not to swear falsely, but not to cause others to swear falsely. We're not allowed to swear by any other god. So if you have to give testimony in the United States, this was fought for in the United States, they tell you, do you swear to say the whole truth, nothing but the truth? Or so you could say, I affirm. You don't have to say, I swear. You're not allowed to swear on their Bible. You could ask for a Jewish Bible, and you could affirm.
Can you swear on the Jewish Bible, or are you still not?
No, you shouldn't swear. We don't swear. The Torah gives a special warning not to sway the court case in the direction of the poor. And here we have a mitzvah of Ashavas Aveda. You encounter a friend's lost object, you have a mitzvah to return it. Now, from here we derive also that you have to save someone else too. You know, if you encounter his animal that's gotten lost, certainly if you encounter him, you got to help a guy out and help him find himself. Finding himself is not only about finding his way back home. It could sometimes mean finding his way back home to himself. Help a guy be who he should be. What happens if you see your enemy's donkey and it's suffering under the load? So the Torah gives us a special mitzvah, help him unload the donkey. So the Talmud questions, why is it described as your enemy's donkey? What enemy might a Jew have? You're not allowed to hate any Jew. So the Torah says it's talking about a guy that it was only you and him in the room. And the guy opens up a pack of bacon. Bacon is pork, right? And he's going to have a snack. So you tell him, that's not kosher. And he says, who's going to know? There are no two witnesses. It's just you and me. So now you know that he's sinning willfully. He couldn't care less. But you also know you can't give testimony. If you walk into court and you're a single witness and you testify that someone did something wrong. So there was a guy named Zingud who did that. He walked into court. And he said, Tuvya sinned the following sin. So Rav said, thank you for telling us. He said, bend them over the steps over there, bend them over the post. They bent Zingud over and they started giving him lashes. So he said, Tuvya chota, Tuvya sinned, the Zingud mingud. Zingud got lashes. How come? Because the Torah prohibits us from going in as a single witness. The courts won't accept your testimony anyway. So that's Lashon Hara. You can't walk in as a single witness. So now you know that guy sinned. And you know he couldn't care less. And on the other hand, you can't do anything about it. So that's a guy where you can hate him. You know the guy is purposely doing avirot, but he figures, who's going to know? So that's what we're talking about. You wish the guy would do tshuva. Now, in that situation, you're going down the street, and you look to your right, and you see his donkey suffering. You look to your left, you see your good friend Chaim, your chavrusa, his donkey's suffering. They both need help taking the load off the donkey. Tells us the Torah, go help the guy you hate. But I'm allowed to eat him, you just said. Says the Torah right. But you got to learn to control yourself. To control and help that guy. Help him, and hopefully you'll help. In helping him, you'll bring him back. So even though we're talking about a guy that you're allowed to hate, you have to help him, says the Torah. Help him first. Take control of your desire, even though you think it's a positive desire. So the Gemara discusses, well, how could you hate him? So the Gemara says, you could only hate him if you could rebuke him. And then the Gemara says, well, who could rebuke? So Rabbi Akiva says, we don't have anyone left who knows how to rebuke. So back in the time of the Mishnah, you had no one left who knew how to rebuke or how to accept rebuke. Because the Talmud says you have to be very smart to know how to say it sweetly and kindly and lovingly so that the guy will walk away loving you. And he has to be so smart that after you give him the rebuke, he'll say, thank you, I'm so appreciative that you gave it to me. Gemara says, in the time of the Mishnah already, there were no longer people on that level. You tell a guy today that he did something wrong, his answer is, and who are you? So that's why we don't rebuke anymore today. And being that we can't rebuke, we also can't hate. Hating is if I could rebuke him or someone could rebuke him and we've tried and he's still insistent in going his belligerent ways, then the Torah says, fine. You could hate him and even then try to control yourself, help him out. Yes?
Are there like certain situations in which you would warn somebody that you don't think knows what they're doing, like how bad it is? I have an example. I know somebody I recently met. Nobody knows him here. But he has a tattoo of Yud Kei Vav Kei on his body. And I told him that this is a very, very, very bad thing. And he should probably talk to a rabbi to see what he could do about it.
And he was like,
what are you talking about? Blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's good. It helps me connect to God. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, it's also in a place. It's very, 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 very bad. You should really talk to a rabbi about it.
No.
And he's just like really like I think like, by telling him that he felt like he got on the defensive and
right.
I don't even know how you would remove such a tattoo because you can't cross out you know
right so, I'll tell you this is something you have to learn. If you have a question, don't throw your question on him first. Find out, maybe he shouldn't do anything. We once had a guy here whose whole body was covered with tattoos which were Hindu prayers. So, we had more than one guy like that here. We had a lot of guys here with their body covered with tattoos. Some hid it and some didn't. The truth is that in all these questions, in the future, you find out what the answer is. Don't burden him with you ask your rabbi. First find out. Maybe your rabbi is going to say there's nothing he could do, nothing he should do, nothing you could do. Kamarnu. Maybe, maybe not. But I would first consult with the rabbi what his answer should be, and then whether you should say something, because usually the attitude is don't say anything. You'll notice here in Machon Meir, the rabbis will rarely, I don't remember ever saying anything to anyone. We don't say anything.
But even that tattoo?
Even that, we don't say anything. Look, if God is bothered by it, let him talk to him, right? So I'm saying a joke, but the truth is that it's not my job.
Yeah.
It's not like it's my chumash, my siddur. It's not my object. And if he did it, I feel bad for him. Maybe one day he'll understand what he did. But the truth is he didn't know better. And you see, he thinks it's a positive thing. So I don't have to be more careful for God's honor than the halacha requires me to. And here I don't think I have to say anything. Quite the contrary. I probably shouldn't say anything.
So should I apologize for like saying something in the first place to
him? I would let it die.
Yeah.
Just be nice then. Yeah. Right.
Just going back to the donkey thing. If your friend sees you going over with the other guy and helping him first, he's going to know you don't like him, but you that you hate him.
I don't think so. You could say, Chaim, sorry, I can't come. I got to help him now. So say something. Yes.
Now, in the case of something like that, where someone has the Hashem's name on his body, now can he change it to like change the letters around so it spells something different?
I don't know. I don't know how we treat tattoos in general with Hashem's name. I don't know the halachos of that. Sorry.
I found that the Rambam in the Surah Tahara talks about the matter of erasing.
Right. And I don't know what the halacha is. Rambam is one opinion in halacha. We have to know what the halacha says. I don't know.
So the Shulchan doesn't deal with
it. I don't know. Yeah.
But there are still people who, you know, you tell telling something that
this is wrong, like this is not according to Halakha, whatever. There's a lot of people still there saying, really? Okay, thank you. There's a lot of people doing this.
Yeah, I'll tell you, in order to tell someone, in order to help someone grow, you have to understand the person, understand the halacha, understand what's best for him to hear and when. I'll give you an example. There was a child who got his tzitzis. So he's 13 years old. He's an orphan. He's having issues in school. And along comes his brother-in-law, who's all learned, and says, you know, it says in Shulchan Aruch, it's a more pious thing for you to wear wool tzitzis. So the kid says, really? Wow, okay. Ma, could I get wool tzitzis? So the mother says, really, you want wool tzitzis? She says, yeah, it's a more pious thing for me to wear wool tzitzis. Okay, did that guy do a good thing or a bad thing so far? Seems like he did a good thing, right? He taught the kid how to keep the mitzvah better. So the mother says, I want to think about it. We're not getting you wool tzitzis so fast. What's the backdrop to this scene? A few months earlier, I taught the kid. I used to give him, I used to tutor him. I called the mother and I said, you know, he's becoming bar mitzvah. And he told me he's getting a new pair of tzitzis for his bar mitzvah. What do you think? Should we tell him about getting wool tzitzis or not? So the mother says to me, no, I don't think we should tell him about getting wool tzitzis. So I said, okay, whatever you think. So then she felt the need to explain. She says, look, he's not doing too hot in school. He's being bugged by a million things. Now the summer's coming up. When he discovers that halacha, then we'll have to think if that's where he's holding right now, that he should get wool tzitzis. Right now, I'll be happier that he speaks respectfully to his teachers, that he does his homework, that he does other things. There are other things that are far more critical. If I'm going to have one more thing nagging him, that the tzitzis are bugging him because they're too hot in the summer, I didn't do him any favors. So when he hits that halacha in Shulchan Aruch, if by then he feels like that's a mitzvah, he should take upon himself, fine. But you know what? There are plenty of opinions that say non-wool tzitzis are also good. So here his brother-in-law thought he was doing him a big favor, but he didn't have the whole picture. His brother-in-law showed up for one Shabbos, saw his brand new tzitzis, he came showing him his new tzitzis, and he hurt him, he didn't help him. And there are many stories like that. In order to help a person in the service of Hashem, you have to understand where a person's holding. You can't just tell him an answer. We had a guy who walked into class here, I don't know if you remember this, you were here, I think, a few years ago, a guy walked into a Binyan HaBayit class. And he said, he comes in and he's dressed like he just came from a bar, which he really just came from a bar. And he's covered with earrings and tattoos and his hair is out to who knows where. And he's sitting here like in an undershirt and shorts. And he sits in on the Binyan HaBayit class, walks in the middle, sits down. And at the end of class, he gets up and says, Rabbi, can I ask a question? I say, okay, yeah. What's your name? We'll make up my name, Joe Schmo. Okay, fine. I just came to Israel, and I've been living my life in whatever city. And every night I go to the bars, and then at night I end up the night with a different girl in my apartment. And now I'm here, and I hear this Binyan HaBayit class about a Jewish home, and I hear about a totally different type of relationship that a person can attain. And it fascinates me. I never knew you could have such a really meaningful relationship. It's amazing. Now, as I was sitting in class, I don't know if you noticed, I walked out three times in the middle. The girl I met at the bar just before I came here has been calling me and inviting me to come over to her place. What do you say, Rabbi? What should I do? This is a true story. In front of the whole class. No shame, no nothing. So I said, I don't know. So all the guys around were all very pious. They all said, what do you mean? It's prohibited. It's this, it's that, it's the other thing. So the guy says, Rabbi, what do you say? I said, I don't know. So the guys are looking at me like I fell off the moon. Like, what's wrong with you? How come you don't know? So,
slow steps,
right? What?
Slow steps.
Right. The guy just walked in here. He doesn't know what Shabbos is. He doesn't know anything. You see, he's not even embarrassed about asking the question. So who said that's the answer he has to hear? You know, the fact that what you're telling him is technically correct doesn't mean it's correct for him. The tradition I have, and this goes back to Rav Gustman in Europe, is that before you paskin a shaila, you have to paskin the person. You have to know where the person's holding before you could answer his question.
The place of the person. This is of course, but I mean,
okay.
I mean, there are
So I don't know of any question. I can't think of a single question unless you ask me, should I murder today? Then the answer is no. You know, there are very few questions that the answer is so finite. Even though the halacha can tell you this is what you should do, but just like this guy, I can't give him that answer right now. I asked him a different question. I said, do you want to stay at Machon Meir tonight? He says, well, I don't have a towel, and I don't have a blanket, and I don't have this. I said, come walk home with me. I'll give you a towel and a blanket and whatever you need, and stay another day or two, and then think about life. And he stayed for months. He didn't stay for a day or two. Now, if I'd have just answered his question head on, yeah, halacha, you know. I don't know if he would have stayed. Maybe he would have stayed one night, maybe. You never know. Maybe he would have stayed more. I don't know. But that's not the answer he had to hear. So I'm not sure that the formula is just, well, what does it say in halacha? I think there's more to the question. Like, we have to understand who we're talking to. The Torah tells us that we have a mitzvah. We plant our land for 6 years. And then the seventh year, we let the land go fallow. And we leave it for the poor and the wild animals. By the same token, we work for 6 days. And on the seventh day, we rest. Explains the Rambam. The Torah wanted us to have vacation in life. People take vacation out of hand. The Torah says, I'll give you vacation. I'll give you 7 days vacation in Pesach time, just before you start harvesting. I'll give you 8 days vacation Sukkot time, just after you finished collecting all your food. I'll give you one out of every 7 days is vacation. More than 1/7 of the year is spent on vacation. And not only does the Torah give us vacation, God gave us a gift, a neshama yaseira. You take the average guy, you tell him, stop what you're doing, don't answer your cell phone, don't deal with your business, just sit back and do nothing for a day. You know, go pray a little bit and eat a meal at night, a meal in the morning, a meal in the afternoon. A guy could handle it once, twice, three times. At some point he says, this isn't productive, I can't do this. So Hashem gave us a special gift called a neshama yaseira, that we have the capacity on Shabbos to do what we couldn't do all week long. Take any day of the week and stay in bed. Go take a nap in the morning after you ate cholent. You'll feel like a bum. You'll feel unproductive. You won't feel good about yourself. On Shabbos, everyone gets up late, goes to daven, then has some children, goes back to sleep, and then goes to daven again and has another meal. What's wrong with us? Nothing. It's a gift. It's a gift that Hashem gave us in Neshama Yisera. So the Rambam says that's the moderation of the Torah, that you're supposed to take vacations, but in moderation. Yes, David.
So would it be considered a waste of time to say, you know, it's like Sunday, you know, like for an entire week, you just want to go to a lot, want to go to Miami, go to Italy. Obviously, a kosher vacation, but just to get away from work, would that be considered a waste of time?
No. Ben Azmanim is coming up, and guys have to take a break. It says it in the Rambam in Shmona Prakim. It says it in the Shulchan Aruch, in the laws of the afternoon. It says technically a person is supposed to try and not sleep in the afternoon, sleep at night. But if a person needs a break, he should take a break. A person has to work with life, not just with theory. So if a person needs a break, he should take a break. You know, Ben Azmanim is coming up, and I hope you guys are planning trips throughout Israel. Go explore the land a little bit. Go up to the Golan. Go. You can volunteer. There's a lot to do, but you guys need a break. You'll learn much better if you take a break. But at the same time, we should have this perspective that the Torah is giving us breaks within our lives as well. Remember that on Shabbos we have a mitzvah that our animals rest as well. So that means you're not allowed to rent out your animals on Shabbos. If you have a stable and your hired hand says, I'll run the stable on Shabbos. You don't even have to pay me. I'll take part of the profits. You can't do that. Your horses have to rest on Shabbos too. The Torah tells us we have the three holidays during the year. On Pesach, we celebrate that we left Egypt. And on Shavuos, we celebrate the receiving of the Torah and the crops that Hashem gave us. And on Sukkot, we celebrate the Sukkot we sat in. And Pesach really corresponds. Pesach takes our food that we eat. Suddenly we eat matzah. And Pesach focuses on Moshe Rabbeinu and Mitzrayim. Moshe took us out of Mitzrayim. We had three shepherds in our history. Who are the three shepherds? Moshe, David, and Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They were the shepherds, right? They were also shepherds. So, Moshe Rabbeinu, that's Pesach. And Pesach, God was walking before us. God was leading the way. And we read Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, about how the lover is always calling his beloved, come after me, come, we'll go out to the fields, and Then we hit Shavuos. What happened on Shavuos? We got the Torah. God was up in heaven, we were down below. So it's a closer relationship. It's not like Pesach where God was leading the way and we were behind. Now it's God's on top and we're on bottom. We're all sitting at the foot of Sinai. Which holidays Shavuos correspond to? Who was born and died on Shavuos? David HaMelech. David HaMelech composed Tehillim. That's praise. We connect Hashem. And we read Megillas Rus. And then, remember Rus, the Giyores? We all became Gerim on Shavuos. And then we advance to Sukkos. Sukkos, before we advance Sukkos on Shavuos, what do? We take our parnasa, we take our crops, and we say the first crops are for you, Hashem. So Pesach, we took our food, our basic bread, and we switch it to matzah. On Pesach, we take our basic bread and switch it to matzah for 7 days. On Shavuos, we take our parnasa and bring it, bikurim, up to the temple. And then we advance to Sukkos. Sukkos is where we build the Mishkan, and Hashem is in the middle of our camp. Now we're really connected. Now we have a home. Sukkos is Hashem took us and brought us into the land of Israel. And we appreciate our home by going out of our home for 8 days, 7 days. We go out to the sukkah. Suddenly I'm not at home. Sukkos is a totally different relationship. Sukkos is now we're family. Now we're connected. On Sukkos we read Koheles, and the connection between Koheles and Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov is for a different time. We have a mitzvah to go and be seen at the temple on these three holidays. And when we're seen, we have a special sacrifice that we bring. That's a korban re'iyah. And that's why, according to the Talmud, every time you walk up to the temple on these holidays, you're in performance of a mitzvah. Rav Eliashiv goes every morning during the holidays, during Sukkos, to the Kotel, to shake his lov and esrog there. At the end of our parsha, God invites Moshe up the mountain and says, come on up, and I want to give you the Torah and the mitzvah and the chukim, etc. And we have on tradition that in this pasuk, God was saying, I'll give you the written law, the oral law, the prophets, everything, all of Torah you're going to receive. So then the question is, then, well, what did Isaiah say if Moshe already had it? So that's why we call the words of the prophets divrei kabbalah, words that are on tradition. It's not that Moshe Rabbeinu was given the exact words of the prophets, but rather every concept that exists in the prophets was already given to Moshe. They didn't teach us anything new that didn't exist earlier. That's why they're called Divrei Kabbalah. The Mishnah, the oral law, that Moshe received at Sinai. The written law as well as the oral law. Hashem says when we conquer the land of Israel, He'll do it slowly, because if He does it quickly, then the animals will take it over. And this way, we can slowly conquer the land and settle the land of Israel. We're going to have to end our class on the parsha here, and we'll Bezrat Hashem, we'll go on to the next class. Any questions? Yes.
So the Torah teaches murder must be.